Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Kent. As you know, I'm the author of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, which is the first book in a trilogy that I wrote for my wife. It's a love story for her, and the story has multiple names from Black History Month, because her father would drill her with Black History flashcards. So that's where Banneker gets his name from Benjamin Banneker. His friend Ellicott Skullworth gets his name from James Ellicott. Latimer City, obviously, is named after Lewis Latimer. And there's also a whole bunch of Batman stuff thrown in there as well. We've got two 11-year-old detectives there on jetpacks. They're chasing down giant robot bees, alligator people. And in the third book, they're going to be facing a cyborg conspiracy. It's a good time. If you want to check that out, the first book, Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, is available as an ebook, a paperback, and an audiobook. And the ebook is free. Free to download whenever you're watching or listening to this, wherever fine ebooks are sold. So go ahead and get yourself set up with that first book for free, and then I've got two more that I'm going to charge you money for. We'll have a good time. Under the super secret pen name Robert Kent, I've written novels for older readers, such as All Together Now, A Zombie Story, and The Book of David, which is a five-volume serial horror story for adults about an atheist that purchases a haunted house that then begins to give him religious visions involving flying saucers. It is nuts, and I love it. If you're a bit demented and bent like I am, you will enjoy it also. That one is, like I say, it's a five-volume serial horror story, but you can get the first book, The Book of David, Chapter 1 by Robert Kent, for free as an ebook. Anytime you're watching or listening to this, anywhere ebooks are sold. Or if you check back, I don't know, at this point, I think 5 or 10 episodes in the catalog, you can hear me read the Book of David Chapter 1 to you absolutely for free. You don't have to read it. I'll read it to you. Just listen to it. You're listening to this. You like listening to things. We'll be fine. And as always, keep up with the show, everything going on with me and everything with the finest authors in the entire universe at middlegradeninja.com. And that is more than enough, my God. My guest tonight is Paula Chase, and we need to get right to it. Paula, how are you this evening?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
I am excellent. I couldn't be more thrilled to talk with you. I've just been enjoying So Done, and I'm now so done with it. And I get to talk with the author, and that's just the thrill that it is to be me, Rob Kent, in this modern age. You get to enjoy a novel and then chat with the author of the novel you enjoyed.
Love book talk.
So usually where I ask folks to start is I will never summarize your book, because you'll stare at me and say, did you read my book at all? That's not what it's about. And I don't summarize other people's biographies. Why would I do that when you're right here and you could tell us what we need to know? So if you wouldn't mind, give esteemed audience an overview of your background.
So I have been writing young adult and upper middle grade since 2007. And now I finally actually know what I write. It's young adult. But because that doesn't really exist in publishing, it is really considered upper middle grade, because my protagonist and my soon to be three upper middle grades are all 13 years old. So they're that audience that's sort of lost in the middle between traditional middle grade and young adult fiction. But I've been doing that for, I guess that's maybe 12 or 13 years. And So Done was my first upper middle grade, my first true upper middle grade. And my book coming out in September, Turning Point, will be my eighth.
It's going well.
I'm doing okay.
I assume I'm talking to you on a gold-plated computer of some kind at this point in your career.
No. Absolutely not. That is not the life of a writer.
I had read something apocryphal about you, and I'll mention it, and then you tell me what's the myth and what's the actual truth. But I had read that you hadn't been that interested in writing, and then you had a job where you ended up, you had money coming in for a little while, but you didn't have to work, so you decided to start writing YA. So tell me about that, the origin story.
So it wasn't that I wasn't interested in writing. I've been a writer my entire life. Everything that I do typically involves writing. Writing is how I communicate best. When I'm angry, I write people letters. When I'm happy, I write people letters. So, you know, expressing myself through writing has always been my thing. Writing novels was not really on my radar, but I do strategic communications and public relations in my day job life. And I came into my tech company that I had been working for, and we knew that layoffs were coming. And sure enough, it was my turn and I was laid off. So about maybe 2 months after I'd been laid off, when finally my head had finally cleared from all the techie stuff, these characters just came into my head. I knew who they were. I knew where they lived, and I just knew a lot about them. So I began to write it down, and that was my very first book. So not the drama, and the characters were 14, and that was actually a series. It was a 5-book series that I did with Kensington. So that's how I came about. My husband was kind enough to allow me to spend a year writing. We just agreed that I wouldn't return to the full-time workforce, and it worked out. We got the book finished, and right about a year, to be perfectly honest, right about a year, I did go back to work. So the book hadn't been published. I hadn't sold it yet, but I did go back into the full-time workforce. And then maybe 6 months after I returned was when I got the book deal.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah.
So you'd have got the book deal before you went back to work. You might have been thinking, oh, well, now I've got this and I'll never need to work again, right?
I might have thought that, but I probably would have gotten a reality check pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah, no, I know none of writers that would have worked out terrible. I'm glad that didn't happen to you.
Definitely.
So what's your first memory of wanting to write fiction? And then when did you decide that young adult is the fiction you would want to write?
I didn't realize that I wanted to write fiction until the character Mila. Mila is so done. See, look at that. I'm getting my characters confused. The character, oh my gosh, can you forget your own character's name? That's like bizarre.
Happens to me all the time.
Mina.
Once the book's done and you wrote it down so you don't have to remember it, right?
That's horrible. It's because their names are too close together. What was I thinking? Mina from So Not the Drama, she came to me and I wanted to tell her story because her story was not necessarily my story, but I grew up the same way she did. So I didn't see a lot of suburban Black girls centered in fiction. And I knew that there was a gap there. So that's when I knew I wanted to write, and the fact that it ended up being young adult just was very organic, because again, I knew that I hadn't seen those type of books out before, especially one that was what was more like popular fiction, so that it wasn't highly literary, what I thought was a little more commercial. I don't know if the market would agree with that, but I just knew that I had never seen it. So I knew that I wanted to fill that gap. I knew that I was writing for the young me. I was writing for the reader in me, the young reader in me.
So what was the process of writing that first novel? After 2 months of getting over the shock, did you just sit down and sit right to it, or how'd that come about?
Yeah, I was writing the novel, but I was also freelancing at the time. So around that time, I would get a couple of freelance jobs. I was writing for Girls Life magazine. I was writing for Black Elegance. I had done a couple articles for Baltimore magazine, but the freelance hustle is grueling. I mean, it's really hard. And you know, you're trying to get these jobs, you're trying to get paid for these jobs. So while I was doing all of that, I was spending the time writing the book. Like I said, I don't think it took me very long. I don't quite remember how long it took, but I think, you know, it probably took me about 3 months to write it, because I, you know, was writing all day in between the freelance gigs, and I didn't have a whole lot of freelance gigs. It was probably just enough to consider myself a freelancer. But So yeah, it was about 3 months, and then the process of finding an agent and actually getting accepted and then getting to a publisher, all of that probably took another, like I said, maybe year.
Which is an amazingly short period of time, as some of these experiences go.
I came to understand that later. You know how it is when you just kind of fall dumb backwards into something. And I hate to say that because it was more strategic than that, but I didn't realize until after I already had an agent just how long sometimes it took for that to happen and just how long it takes sometimes to sell a book. So I was fortunate, but I think it was having that time to fully allow the characters to speak to me and let me know what their story was that really helped. It's a lot harder for me now because I do still have a day job. So it's more of an effort to say, I will sit down at my lunch hour and write for an hour before I return back to day job, or I will, you know, not go to bed until a little later so that I can get it done. So it's a little different.
So how do you hold yourself accountable? What's a good writing day look like for you now?
So when I'm under contract, and there is definitely a difference in that what that day looks like. When I'm under contract, it looks something like the Tasmanian devil when he's I don't think anybody wants to know what's up here. It's quite a mess. But I have learned to turn it on and off. And that sounds wonderful. It's not that wonderful because it usually takes me 20 minutes to drop myself into the story. I do a lot of rereading. So I always read whatever the last chapter that I wrote, and it helps me to kind of get in the mood and get my mind right. But it still takes 20, it can sometimes take up to 30 minutes before I actually feel the rhythm of the story return. And granted, my lunch hour is only an hour, so that's not always great. So, you know, but when I'm under contract and I have to get those words done, it's just something, you know, that I do until it becomes a little bit more rhythmic for me and until I'm less afraid of the blank pages in front of me. When I'm not under contract, I honestly tend to not write, you know, like what I've been doing lately, because I just turned in a manuscript, is I've been thinking of story pitches. Like I haven't necessarily wanted to start a new book because I need the break a little bit, but I've been doing story pitches, and that's been kind of fun and cool for me because it's allowing me to, you know, form these characters. They're not as organic. I'm actually manufacturing them, which is not typically how I write, but it's interesting.
So are you, where on the spectrum of pantser versus plotter would you say that you fall?
100% pantser, 100%. I am so afraid of plotting. I don't know why, but it's something about having to write that out that never works quite as well for me, which is why sort of these story pitches are, it's interesting for me because it's as close as I've ever come to plotting out a book before. So yeah, I usually like to, I don't know what's going to happen in the story until I'm finished. I never do.
You wrote all of So Done without knowing where the ending was going to be?
I've never outlined a book. I have never plotted a book.
That's amazing to me. So how does that work? Do you just sit down, I've got a character? When do you start a story, and how do you know where to start if you don't know where you're going yet?
Well, all of my stories are very character-driven. They're always about that person, their experience, their emotional growth. So it is very much about me knowing that person and getting to know that person as I'm writing them and who they're interacting with. I like to put all of my, like, I know that all of my characters, I know essentially what they want. Like with Mila, she wanted to move out of the cove. She wanted to move with her aunt and her older sister. So I knew that's what she wanted. The other things that I knew was that she had this alpha best friend who was a little pushy, and she was kind of tired of that. She wasn't, she was a little fearful of her own neighborhood, despite her father trying to help her understand that their circumstances caused, or other people's circumstances caused the neighborhood to have some of the strife that it did. So like, I knew that about her. And so then the rest of the story was about getting her, was she going to achieve her goal or not? And it was about the journey to that end of whether or not she was going to achieve her goal. But in the middle of that, you know, there was Tay's story as well, and they were intermingled. So yeah, I just kind of, every chapter was about each of those characters and their goals and how they clashed or how they matched. And yeah.
So I definitely have lots of follow-up questions for those members of esteemed audience who haven't just enjoyed So Done. That's the novel we're talking about for the moment. If you wouldn't mind, give esteemed audience kind of an overview of what they need to know about So Done so we can talk about it.
So Done is about two friends, and it's a friendship story, but a friendship at a crossroads. They have been friends for many, many years, and the one friend has returned from visiting her aunt for the summer, and the other friend is very excited to have her back and doesn't quite understand why her friend is not quite as excited to be back home. This is a wedge between them, the fact that Neela wants to move away and Tay doesn't understand why she doesn't love their neighborhood as much as she does. And what we find out eventually is that there's a secret that Neela has been holding, and it's a burden on her, and it has to do with Tay's father. And it's one of the reasons why she wants to move away. And it's something that she is trying to contend with in her own way without having to reveal it to anybody. And it's something that Tay kind of feels might have something to do with, but she's not quite sure, and she sort of discounts it. So it's about a friendship that is trying to figure out whether it will continue to be a friendship, but it's also about the importance of not keeping secrets. And it's a very heavy issue, but I hope that the way that I've dealt with it, still the focus of the story is their friendship and how they're both groping with this change, that are dealing with this change that they're going through.
So, and I fell in love with that girl, Tay, immediately. She made me laugh multiple times, and yet as the story progressed, I started to see things from Mila's perspective. I'm like, you know what? Maybe if Mila wanted to go on and have some new friends. And I could feel like I wasn't sure which way the story was going to go. And obviously, if you didn't have a preconceived idea, there weren't necessarily hints. But there were hints that you start dropping early about this thing that's happened between Mila and Tay's father, without spoiling. So that there had to be a little bit of plotting in there for you to know that. Or did you go back and start hinting at that once you figured it out? That was that second draft and third draft type stuff.
I swear to you, I just don't plot. It's all about the character. It's all about, does it feel right for this character? What would I do if I were this character and I wanted this and this was in my way? It was all of that. Now, I will say this. Mila is mentioned in my young adult series because that contains her older sister, Jacinta, who we only see very little bit in So Done. But one of the things that I always knew about Mila and which helped to drive the story, which is why I didn't have to plot it out, was I always knew that she and Tay had sort of this little bit of friction in their friendship because Tay is so bossy. And so it was really about kind of peeling the layers back on, well, why is she so bossy? And we start to see why Tay is the way she is. You know, she's being raised by her grandmother. She's has this father who is, you know, right in the middle of arrested development. I mean, he's irresponsible. He uses drugs. you know, we see these things and we start to understand, you know, maybe why she's so defensive all the time, why she perhaps is trying to always control her friendship because there's so many other things in her life that she can't control. When I know those kind of things about a character, it makes it, I don't want to say easy, but it makes it a little more organic for me to develop a story around them because they are acting on their own, but then how they act, their friends are going to react to that. And I just keep playing off of the characters, you know, I just keep making them clash or making them get along, which is going to make somebody else upset. I mean, it's just like a typical middle school friendship. That's what I wanted to put on display.
Amazed, because you the conflict never stops, the ball never drops, every chapter keeps the story going. I didn't get to the part where this kind of meandered out of here. I guess the author didn't have a plan. It never feels like that. So how many drafts are you doing to make it 100% cohesive, or are you Mozart and you do the one draft, the notes are all perfect, and then you walk away?
No perfection is involved, but I do tend to be a pretty tight writer. I do tend to only have a single draft that I then send off to a freelance editor who I've been using the same freelance editor for years. And she's edited almost all of my books. Not, I don't think she did three of my series books because by then I knew the character so well that I just went on. But so it's a first draft. It's to her. She tells me what she thinks. She gives me her thoughts. There's usually that second draft that I base my notes on, and then I send it to my publisher. And then if she has any notes, then maybe there's a third draft. But usually, because I use an outside editor, I don't usually need a third draft. It's usually just kind of copy edit stuff by then. But honestly, that my, I don't want to call it a luxury, but because I have a day job, I work really hard to make sure that that story is finished when it's finished. I don't really have time to dwell on it a lot because, you know, I have the deadline that's driving me and I need to move on. Like, you know, like I hate to say it like I'm ADD, but I've got to move on. So I write pretty tight. It's not perfect by any means, but it's usually tight enough that my editor doesn't have a lot. She may have some, I question this, are you sure about that? But I usually don't have like big gaping holes, like what in the world were you doing right here? So, so far anyway, not good. Not good. So, it's coming, I mean, though. It's coming.
How much do you have to provide to get on contract? How much do you actually have to have on paper before you know that you've got a thing that even though you don't have a full plot or whatever, you know you're going to get to a certain point by presumably by the time you have to turn in the book to meet your contract?
You mean when I'm presenting it to my publisher?
Uh-huh. Yeah. What do you present them with?
So Done was completely finished when Green Willow purchased it. So it wasn't a pitch or anything like that. It was completely done. And then they bought Dope, they offered Doughboys. So it was a 2-book contract based solely on So Done and me saying to my editor, and I think I want to do a story that focuses the lens on the two boys. And she was like, okay. So it was, she just knew it was going to be about the two boys. She had no idea. My editor is very trusting. And and I love her.
You must have earned that trust at this point, though, because this isn't your first rodeo.
It's not, but it is hard for me to write a book at this point in my career, right? It's hard for me to write a book just for me. Because what I'm trying to do is continue to establish myself as a writer. And so right now, like when I'm not under contract, because I've turned in the last book under the current contract, that's why I'm like, okay, I have this pitch idea and let's see if we can sell it just based on a proposal. I want to do that because I can write the book, but I'd rather write it knowing that I'm going to be paid for the book. So if, you know, if no one bites on the proposal, then, you know, that gives me the freedom to, now I can finish it as, you know, I can take as long as I want. I haven't had that situation for a while, so it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, but yeah.
Yeah, but getting paid's great.
getting paid's pretty great.
Big fans of that on this show. Well, I'm fascinated by a couple of things you said. We finish up with Sota. Just who is the ideal reader for the story, and when do you know that, or is that decided during the contract? When is that decided who the ideal reader is going to be?
The book was pitched as a middle grade, because I had always been told that my young adult was sweet YA. And I never quite understood the term, because does that mean other books are not sweet? I don't know. So I was, you know, people would say to me, you know, you really should write middle grade. Your voice is a little younger. So I did. And we pitched it as middle grade. And then I realized that middle grade was really for 8 to 9 year olds. And I did not write a book for 8 and 9 year olds. So I've been on a quest ever since, because I'm always stuck in the middle where people don't know where to put me. My YA wasn't YA enough. And now my middle grade is not middle grade enough. So that's why I've been trying to understand what I write, and have come to the terms that it's young adult, because the characters that I like to portray are between the ages of 13 and 15. And those readers tend to literally be stuck and forgotten in between traditional middle grade and traditional young adult. So even though I didn't start out saying, hey, I really want to write for this reader, I started out playing the game like everybody else does. Publishing tells me what the book is. I write it and they tell me this is the age group that this book is for. And I go, okay. Now I'm starting to realize it's not so okay, because I am still in the middle of how they categorize a book. To me, my books are for these two books, So Done and Doughboy, are for 13, 14 year olds. And it could be for a 12-year-old, but on my books, it says 8 to 12, I think. But the content in these books that I write, I think, are a little much for an 8 or 9-year-old. Maybe an avid 10-year-old reader, but still, I really am writing for the middle schooler. I really am. And that's a new development. A new development, because the publisher considers my books middle grade. They don't put upper in front of it. They just call it middle grade.
Does that ever lead to negative reactions from readers who are expecting that, you know, Mila and Tay are going to find a chocolate factory, and instead here's Dad who's on drugs?
Wow. When you put it like that, you know, so far I've not had any challenges with it, but it's also because I network quite frequently with educators so that they are clear. And so I used to feel bad saying these books are not for 8 and 9 year olds, because I'm going directly against what the publisher says. You know, they can look in the catalog and they say, hey, but this says here. And I just say, well, it's just because, you know, 13 year olds tend to get caught in the middle, and publishers have not yet come to terms with the fact that there needs to be two more categories created in order for us to truly capture all of the potential readers. I think they will catch up eventually. They have not so far, but I'm on a mission to make sure that it happens. So I actually, with Tracy Batiste, and I had just created this document. We crowdsourced it on Twitter, where we just asked all these authors, like, if your characters are between 13 and 15, add them to our YYA column. If your characters are between 11 and 13, but it has to involve relatively you know, mature content, then, you know, put it on our upper middle grade column, because we're trying to make sure that teachers know the difference and can properly hand sell, book sell, recommend the book to the right reader. So we're going to push it from the ground up.
Oh, this interview is going to be revolutionary. The longer it goes, people got to look back and like, this is the moment when it became MG, YA, and PC for the Paula Chase category. That's where these upper middle grade books belong. So are you, I mean, you're kind of making up rules as you go a little bit then, because there's definitely some adult content in this, and yet I could feel, I don't know if it's just me because I have a sick mind, where there were some moments where I wanted profanity and I could feel the text almost straining. You used which a couple of times where I'm like, that's not the word you wanted there, but you're compromising and I appreciate it. So do you bump your head against whatever ceiling that would be, the no profanity, but we can get away with? How do you decide what you can get away with and what would boost you up into past sweet YA?
Yeah.
Into, I guess, cruel YA or whatever they call that.
Right. There's always sort of this teen curse, no curse thing. If it's a middle grade novel, which again, your reader is, if it's a traditional middle grade novel and your reader then is an eight to 9 year old, then I agree, there should be no cursing. However, my characters are 13. I think that as parents, we have to come to terms with the fact that our kids live this life outside of us when they are in school and when they are with their friends. I am always first true to my characters. There are always going to be characters in my book who just naturally cursing would not fit who they are and how they talk. But then there are going to be characters where absolutely it fits. And I don't worry about what anybody else thinks about it if I feel like it's authentic to that character. So, you know, what you find in So Done, I think, is there may be a curse word or two, and I think only the boys curse. I know Mila doesn't curse. I don't think that Tay does. But in Doughboys, there's cursing. The boys curse. And to be honest, based on what happens in Doughboys, if cursing is the worst thing they do, they're doing okay. And I think that's, you know, again, you have to, that's what I'm dealing with. The reality that these kids, you know, cursing is the mildest thing that they could do or could get themselves into. I've not had any pushback from my publisher. I've not had any pushback from teachers. Again, as long as I try to explain who the reader is, I think the teachers tend to be okay with it because it's very mild and it's, you know, I mean, I've never counted, but it's probably, you know, less than 8 times in the whole book or something. It's probably less than that.
I wore pearls just so I could clutch them each and every time. So when one of the process, did you know that you wanted the boys to have a spinoff story of their own? And how did you accommodate that? Did you know in the middle? Did you know up front before So Done is complete? When did you know?
I knew once So Done was complete that I wanted to focus on the boys. But also at that point, I had promised my editor that that the next story would be about the boys. I didn't know what the story would be. But I remember when I wrote the scene where Mila is talking to her brother JJ, and he says to her, you know they're Doughboys, right? And she's surprised. I mean, these are her friends. She's known them for years. They've grown up together, and she wasn't aware. Where we find that Tay pretty much suspects, and you know, she's hip to it and she's kind of intrigued by it. And so I knew then when I wrote that scene where JJ mentions it and Mila is not only surprised, but she's saddened by it. She doesn't want that to be true. She doesn't want to believe that that they're involved in helping to sell drugs. So that's when I knew what the crux of the story would be. It would be them, how did they get into it and how are they dealing with it? It was very important to me that their humanity be shown, because very frequently when we think about young boys and girls out there doing something like helping somebody to sell drugs or whatever, you know, we're immediately ready to reprimand, we're ready to, you know, shame, and we forget that there may be circumstances that led to it, some out of their control. And I wanted to put that story out there.
I love that she had the back and forth between Mila and her father, who fancies himself. I think you said he's a ghetto professor. I guess while he's washing dishes, he's lecturing about the Cove and the community. And there's been this recent article about how terrible the Cove is that makes it sound like it's, you know, the zombie torn wasteland. And you could kind of show both perspectives that way. I don't know if there's a question there. I just like that you did that.
There was no question. Yes, I love Jamal's character, because I think it's, again, it's important to show that the low income, working class projects where people live, these people are still working. These people are still, like, it's, you know, I think it's so easy for people to believe, to have one vision in their head of what a neighborhood like the Cove is like. And I wanted to make sure that people understood it's a neighborhood like any other. You know, there are parents out there, you know, working and doing the best they can to raise their kids, and their kids are out there exploring the world beyond their parents. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. So Jamal is my, he's my voice of reason, because he's a single father raising three kids. And so he obviously, you know, he's working 8, 9, 10 hours a day, whatever the case might be. So he can't be there all the time, but he wants them to understand that, you know, their neighborhood is only as good as they make it.
So when you're doing a shared universe, the Polychase universe, as it is, one, how do you keep your continuity straight? But then also, how do you make sure that we get to see all our the characters that we fell in love with and so done again in Doughboys without it being a sequel, with it being its own thing? How do you fight your own temptation? I want to spend more time with the characters I love so much.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, they call it a companion book. So it's not a series, but they call Doughboys a companion book because it's in the same world, but I am focused on two different characters. And it was important to me that it, first of all, I hope that you can read one without reading the other, or I hope you could read them out of order if you wanted to. I think that you can. But what was real important to me was that the friendship stay consistent, that it's the same friendship. We're just seeing it through two different characters' eyes. And so when we see Simp and Raleigh in So Done, Simp is more of a sidekick almost. We get the feeling, just based on what Tay says to us, that Raleigh is the alpha friend and Simp is just always tagging along, and she just wishes that he would leave Simp home sometimes. And so we get the impression that Simp might be, you know, sort of quiet. I mean, he, you know, he mouths off, but again, we think he's the secondary friend. But in Doughboys, we realize that that's not necessarily the case. So the first time that my editor read Doughboys, she commented on that, and she said, Simp seems more talkative than I seem to remember. And I said, but that's because you're remembering him through the lens that the girls saw. And when the camera is on Simp, he's different. And when you read Doughboys, you'll see that. You'll see the things that are on Simp's shoulders. You'll see what motivates him. And so it wasn't that he was ever quiet or that he was ever a sidekick. It's just that to the girls in their opinion. That's how they see him. And that's what I wanted to do with the story. Every time the lens is on somebody different, you know, you're going to see them step up a little bit and their character is going to come to life a little bit more because they're the ones in front of the camera and everybody else has to fade back a little bit. So, and that was fun to do because the difference between doing that versus when I used to write, when I did my series, is that with the series, they all were a little equal. That ensemble, everybody, you know, sort of had their chance to be in front of the lens based on what went on in the chapter. And that didn't happen in these two books. It was only about those kind of two characters at a time. So it was a little easier for consistency because everybody else faded and muted just a little bit. But also I did have to, you know, remember things and keep things consistent so that I didn't, you know, add somebody with a sibling when they didn't say they had one before. So that kind of stuff I did have to keep up with.
So are you keeping like a separate appendix someplace just for you, or is it all up here? I'm pointing to my head for a podcast.
I wish that I had an appendix. I did for my series. I remember getting it from like my copy editor and I was so excited. I'm like, oh my gosh, all these details, their screen name and their, and it was wonderful. Did not have the same for this. So what I find is that I always have to have a copy of, like when I was writing Turning Point, I had to have a copy of Doughboys and Soda near me because I have to look back at certain stuff. Like I literally forget like, well, what was her last name? You know? So I do have to keep, the other books handy.
Okay. So Turning Point will be set in the Cove universe.
Yeah. The lens is on Rashida and Monique.
And Turning Point comes out when?
September 15th.
September 15th, esteemed audience, I bet if you search hard enough, you might even could pre-order your copy right now.
I bet you could.
I know that you don't plan the individual novels, but do you have like kind of a plan for the Cove, that this is where they all get together for the Infinity War or whatever?
I love that. I don't, you know, it's funny because I like to stay in a world for a long time because it helps me to get comfortable. It makes it easier to write because I know those characters so well. And I would love to do another Cove book. I'd love to focus on the twins, Chris and Chrissy. But I don't know, we'll see. That's gonna be up to my publisher at this point. The next book after Turning Point is completely different because they wanted something completely different. And it's completely different in that it's a totally separate world. It's first person point of view. And it scares me a little bit because I'm not as comfortable in writing in that point of view. I seem to be the only person who finds that a difficult voice to write in. I am a freak of nature, apparently. So I like
her. I'm not person. Sure that's what that means. But it sounds like the book is sold. So you must have pulled it off.
We'll see. I'll let you know.
So we can't plug that one yet. Not an official title or a date yet. Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you also about you must have some way of doing research because I'm intimidated by great YA because even when I spend time with teens, I don't feel confident that I can reproduce their voices. Mm-hmm. And I think I mentioned earlier that I write detective fiction. And mm-hmm. as we've been talking, I have deducted that you are not a teenager.
I am not.
Somewhere there, you must be doing some kind of research, keeping current, because you've got them, you know, you've got text conversations going back and forth, very convincing between two teens. So how are you doing that research to keep current with what's going on?
I am young at heart. I don't research. I am a really big fan of pop culture and I keep myself immersed in it just naturally. I do have a 16-year-old daughter, but all of my books have been written outside of my kids being that age. When I wrote my series, I think my oldest daughter was only 9, and then my youngest daughter wasn't even born. And then when I wrote So Done, that was 2018. So my youngest daughter, you know, she would have only have been maybe 8 herself. No, well, I don't know. I'm really bad at math, which is why I write. My point is that I don't really, you know, I don't eavesdrop on teens. I just, you know, I know Black teens well enough. I've been around them enough. I've been one. I am comfortable with creating slang if I don't want to use current slang, because it's really just about how you use it. Slang is just, you know, shortened language, right? It's just a vibe. And I'm very comfortable creating that vibe between my characters. I don't worry about, hey, are kids saying this anymore? I never worry about that. I write what I think these characters, I write how I think they would speak. And I think most of the time, I hope that the story flows enough that people can suspend their belief long enough to say, okay, this is how these particular characters talk, and not try to connect it to, do other teenagers talk that way? I just, you know, I just never worry about it.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, even teens that are reading the novel, they know how teens around them talk. Although now that they're all on Zoom, thanks to that quarantine for COVID-19, maybe they have a whole new perspective on worldwide teenagers. But up to this point, you don't know that the next town over, or wherever the cove is, you don't know that they're not talking that way there.
Yeah. It comes natural to me, but again, it's because I'm a consumer of pop culture. So, you know, I like to watch certain things, and it's not so much research as it is, it's what I enjoy watching to turn my brain off. So it doesn't, it's not hard to kind of stay in that mindset. But also I really, I enjoy writing about teens, because when you're 13 or 14 years old, there's still a lot of discovery there, not just about your surroundings, but about who you are. And I just enjoy writing about that. So
do you do, when you're not, you know, on deadline and working the day job all day and everything else, do you do a lot of reading of YA novels still?
I try to. What I tend to do is I binge read. When I have free time, I'll try and buy like 3 or 4 books or 5 books and try to read them in like a span of a couple of days. And that sort of refreshes me and keeps me kind of grounded in the type of writing that I do. But it's difficult to do that when I'm under contract, because I also don't like to fill my head with that many voices. And so it can be difficult to read it, to read anything even close to what I write. So I like to read horror or mystery, you know, like I try to go so opposite of everything that I write, just so that reading can actually be enjoyable. Because if I'm reading the same type of stuff that I write, then I start processing, like, you know, my brain turns off and I start breaking down sentences like, oh, that was interesting. You know, I can't enjoy it because now I'm working. So, but yes, I do go on a couple of good binges when I can.
And I've learned to stop asking this question because it's a first-class way to, next time you go to an author event, how'd you like to be alienated from the other YA authors there? So we're not going to ask you, what YA authors do you most like to read? That's crazy. Who are some authors larger than life, above reproach, that we can all agree are amazing, who have, you think, maybe most influenced your work?
The authors who have influenced my work are not going to surprise you, just because I think any person of a certain age were influenced by these same people. In particular, Mildred Taylor, the author of Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, was a big influence on me as a reader, and she is one of the reasons that I'm able to be very comfortable writing very earnest fiction. That word was a word that an agent said about my work when I was submitting, So Not the Drama. She said, I really like it. It's a bit too earnest for me. And I thought, is that a bad thing these days? Like, I didn't know. So it made me realize what she was saying was that, you know, that I tend to, you know, really get real about what my characters are going through. And I guess she just, you know, she wanted something that was a little less complex maybe, but I wear that as a badge of honor because Mildred Taylor was that type of writer. You can't write about the hardcore racism and segregation like she did in that book. And the main character of Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry was 9 years old. And when you think about what happens in that book and think about the age of the intended reader, it's like, wow, you have to be an excellent author in order to carry that off. And she did. I mean, that book is beloved. So she is a huge influence. And then the other one is Judy Blume, because I grew up reading all of her books. She too has this way of being incredibly honest with the reader and the ability to get into her young character's head and make you feel what they're feeling. So reading those two women, I like to think that my writing is similar to them, just in that I'm not afraid to put any topic in front of a young reader because I feel like I can be trusted with putting that information in front of them in a way that won't harm them, but will help them feel seen and, you know, reflected.
Well, realistically, if you sat down a book in front of a, you know, a 12, 13-year-old American teenager, they're not going to go, gasp, racism is a thing in America? Really? I can't even believe what I'm seeing. Mind blown.
I believe you're right.
Well, I've got lots of questions for you about lots of topics, but I always try to throw this out there before we move on from So Done and the Cove series. I've always want this show to be, when I started the show, I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if this was the type of show that if I were being interviewed, I would want to be on. And so my laziest question is the question I would most want for myself, which is, what is a question that you haven't been asked about the Cove series that you would love it if somebody more insightful than me had asked, and that you could share information that you want to share about the series? Yeah, that's the question. No question. Free spot.
Okay. I don't know if I have a question that I want to be asked, but I do.
This is awkward. I will edit this part out. No, I'm teasing.
It's tough, right? Because like you don't know what you don't know. But you know what? I do know that I want people to approach this book knowing that my books aren't like I've been hearing a lot of people say. Authors need to just shut up and write, you know, don't get political or you'll see people unfollowed on Twitter because an author said something. And my books are my politics in that, you know, I want people to see these readers and I mean, see these characters. And hopefully if you're an educator, if you're a librarian, if you're a parent, that if you know some children who are like, Tay or Mila or Raleigh or Simp, that you just walk away feeling more empathy than maybe you did before, and that you can recognize, you know, a Black child on the street, and rather than be intimidated by their locks, you know, or their hoodie, you know, that you think. That's what I want these type of books to do.
So by that logic, the ideal reader we went back to is the police. Read these books, police officers. We learn empathy. I shouldn't laugh if I have to because I'll cry otherwise. Okay, moving on. Well, you know what? You mentioned politics. Let's while we're here, I noticed you spend some quality time on Twitter. You're familiar with social media, and you do get openly political. Also not nonstop. That's not all it is, but there's some politics on there, mine too. How do you manage that? Do you ever worry that some of that might be going too far? Do you ever listen, not to just shut up, but like, hey, at the end of the day, am I reaching anybody? I always think that if what can I say that Donald Trump hasn't already said that should convince you he's terrible? If he hasn't convinced you of that, what difference is the middle grade ninja going to make at this point? So what advice would you have for writers in being political openly?
I always try to just be me on Twitter. And what that means for me is I want to always engage positively. So when I'm angry about something, if I put something on my timeline, then I must really be angry about it, because I don't, I always want to be real. But I also know that it's hard to engage when you only have however many characters they're allowing us these days. Is it 260? I can't keep track. But, it's hard to have... it's hard to have a true conversation that way. So I'm mindful of that. But if I put it on my timeline, I usually will stand behind it. And so that's my advice. If, as long as you stand behind it, then say it. The people who, well, I'm going to, kind of delete that tweet or why? I mean, just think before you put it on. That's all. And so there are some things that I probably would never put on my TL because I know that I can't explain it in a tweet if someone were to, call me on it. So usually if I put it on there, I don't mind standing behind it.
Something that occurred to me is in your book, you've got these social media sites that you reference. I think it's Friendly or Friendme.
Friendme.
Is that just kind of your alternate word? Why? Because everything else in the book is pretty consistent. I expect that if there's a Ben Diesel movie in this universe, that exists in that universe also. Why the divergence with the social media sites?
Because, I've tried to give the publisher that opportunity so that it's not too much material in there that'll date it. And so that's just a way to keep it slightly evergreen. Even with slang, which is why I made the point earlier, of course slang changes, but I tend to use the same slang with my characters because it's not so much what they're saying, it's the fact that, they're just talking relaxed. So I don't worry about, do people still say this word? And that's how I try to do it with the social media, to avoid the, 10 years from now when people are like, what's Twitter now? I don't know if they're going to say that, but we know how fast social media.
Well, no, they'll have been reading about it in their history books. This is what ended right. The United States. Oh, interesting.
But I did do that on purpose, just to try to keep it somewhat evergreen, so we wouldn't have to worry about later editions, because I want my books to live as long as possible. And so, I don't want them to worry about it and say, oh, look, you referenced a MySpace and that doesn't exist anymore. Nobody uses it. So that was my way of sort of playing with it.
That is a brilliant tip and I'm going to steal it going forward. That is smart. I like it.
Yep.
Well, let's see. Some other questions I absolutely had for you is, let's get this out of the way. Esteemed audience knows I have to ask. Paula Chase, have you ever seen a flying saucer and do you believe in them?
I've never seen one, but I totally believe in them because I always think to myself, this world is pretty big and we'd be really arrogant to think that we're the only ones here. So, yep, I believe they've got to be out there somewhere.
I will also accept ghost stories. Have you seen any ghosts?
You know what? I feel like I have. When I was, and I wasn't even like little, so this is why I feel in my gut that it's true. When I was about 19, my aunt passed away. And I remember it was shortly after her services, and we were having like sort of a repast at the house. And there was this wispy kind of white lightness that kind of went past the house. And then we were that, like the next day, we were at my grandmother's house, which is not far from where my house is. And I saw it again. And I always felt that was her. I always thought that was her.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. I love a good ghost story. Let's make sure we talk a little bit about the Brown Bookshelf. So please tell us about the site and your mission to, according to the site, to push awareness of the myriad Black voices writing for younger readers. I love that. What is the Brown Bookshelf?
The Brown Bookshelf is essentially a blog, but it's a little bit more than that. It is our labor of love. Every year, we select 28 Black creatives to amplify during February. And it's funny because that initiative is called 28 Days Later. And you mentioned zombies when you
were. Oh, of course. There was no chance I wasn't going to bring up zombies.
And the irony is that when we created it, and I was the one who named it, and I can remember, I think Varian was like, are we sure we want to name it that? That's a zombie movie. And I said, yeah, because 28 days later, people will walk away, you know, armed with the names of 28 creatives that either they didn't know before or whose, you know, new work they weren't aware of. And I said, so, you know, I just think it's appropriate. Like, it has nothing to do with zombies, but, you know, the fact that it may pique people's interest that way is, you know, it's only fun. It's a fun plus. But when I was given my first contract, one of the first things that I thought about was how it's very difficult for Black creatives to get exposure. They tend to be underexposed. They tend to be distributed. They're not as distributed as well, or at least they weren't. And it's still the case, but back in 2007, for sure. And I went to Varian Johnson and I said, you know, what if we created a site to just bring attention to the other Black children lit authors out there? Because it didn't seem like there were a lot of us, because that's how underexposed they were. And he was just nuts enough to say yes. And so we wrote Kelly Starling Lyons and Dawn Tate into it. And we, and at the time, Carla Surratt was part of our original group. And it was just a very simple thing. We would pick, I can't remember the number, but most of the authors or authors and illustrators were under what we considered under the radar. But then we would also select some who were pioneers, trailblazers, you know, people who had paved the way. And we've been doing it ever since. And it's a labor of love for certain, because it's a lot of work. We are all creatives ourselves. So we're taking, you know, time away from our own writing, our own illustrating to do this. But yet we have never failed. We continue to do it. And we've actually grown in trying to feature so that we do it beyond February. But for the longest time, that's all we had the bandwidth for. So we're attempting to be a little more consistent. And some of the initiatives that we've taken on now are to just help to defeat anti-Blackness and to promote, you know, anti-racism. So we stay busy.
I hope that Varian Johnson finally gets an opportunity. It's tragic that he's faded into obscurity all these years.
This poor man.
Why won't someone give him a break? What working with a site like that, you must have come into contact, aside from the obviously extremely noteworthy Varian Johnson, you must have come into contact with all sorts of fascinating, interesting people. What kind of networking opportunities has being involved with the Brown Bookshelf opened up for you?
So I don't know about that it's opened up networking for me. I know that it's a platform that I'm very proud of. I find it a lot easier to amplify other voices and to advocate for inclusion in literature than I find to just talk about my books all day. So for me, it's been a way to keep my name out there, but beyond just talking about my own work. And it's my way of sort of paying it forward. I always hope that when we talk about Black children's authors, that my name will be in the mix somewhere, because as an author, like, we dream of having a kid say, oh, I read you. You know, I remember reading you when I was a kid. So, you know, yeah, like, I want that. But it's also important to me that Black creatives are able to establish themselves with that kind of name recognition in general. Because like I said, when we started, to me, it felt like, where are all the Black authors? As if they didn't exist. I knew they existed. I just knew I didn't hear about them. So it's important for us to make sure that that doesn't happen anymore, or at least that it doesn't happen as often.
And where can a student audience who's leaned forward, listening closely, saying, yes, I want that also. I 100% support anti-Blackness, because only the best people listen to the Middle Grade Ninja podcast. where can they go to support the Brown Bookshelf, and how can they get involved?
So you can go to thebrownbookshelf.com. We, as far as support is concerned, we just want people to visit the page. We want people to make sure that they amplify the voices that they see when they're looking for a book by a Black creative. Then we hope they come to us first, because our 28 days later, you know, we have like 12 years worth. And, you know, we have other features on there, but that's 12 years is a lot of creatives. So if they're not on our site, man, I don't know, because we covered a lot of evil. But we are also looking at ways to categorize them differently. Like right now, you would literally have to go through every single year and just kind of look through. I mean, we have a search engine, so you can do that. But we're thinking about, you know, perhaps using a different tactic. So if anybody ever wanted to volunteer some time and help us do that, that'd be great. But mostly we just want the eyeballs on the site and for people to help us amplify the authors that they see on there.
Obviously, to share every post they come across on social media, help spread the word, esteemed audience.
Absolutely.
And while you're doing it, tweet out the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You got to do the work, people.
Something I read about you is you describe your writing as a phrase I hadn't heard come across before, but I love it. It's hip lit. What is hip lit?
Yeah, I totally made that up. And I called it that, and that I created that phrase back when I did my series. So my first series book came out in 2007, and it was just my version of like hip hop literature. And all it meant was that, you know, you were seeing contemporary Black kids in, you know, middle class and working class environments. Before my book came out, a lot of the books that were most prominent, and that's still sort of the case now, but a lot of the books that were most prominent were the historical fiction, were the stories where it was the, you know, perhaps the character was from an inner city. You rarely got to see characters from the suburbs. And as we have been saying especially recently, you know, where were the Black Joy books? Where are the books where, you know, kids are just being kids? And that's what Hip Lit was for me. It was these kids, they were very much immersed in hip hop culture in terms of the type of music that they listened to, the slang that they used, you know, and they were just formed by hip hop. And so I just called it that because that's what it felt like.
And that segues naturally to something I can't help but ask you about. You met Flavor Flav. How'd that happen?
Yeah, boy. I was in college, and I'm a sorority girl. I'm in Alpha Kappa Alpha, and my sorority sister, her cousin was in Public Enemy at the time. And she had played a part in getting them to come down. I went to James Madison. And she had played a part in getting them to come down and do a concert. So they did. And some of us were able to hang out in the green room after the show. And so I don't know how it came about, but Chuck D asked some of us if we wanted to go to breakfast. And the only thing in Harrisonburg back then was a Waffle House. So a couple of us went to the Waffle House and we just hung out and had breakfast with them. And it was fun. It was, what was interesting was that, you know, outside of his stage persona, you know, which is probably like a little goofy and silly or whatever, he seemed to be a really down-to-earth, cool guy. And I can remember years later watching him on the Flavor of Love, when he did his reality show with VH1. And there were moments, you know, when he would interact with the women on there that, you know, that was the guy who we met that night. Like he just seemed like he was a really, you know, caring person. And I saw that come through on Flavor of Love. And it was kind of, you know, weird because I know that mostly he got the show for his persona, but, you know, real glimpses of who he seemed to be that night came through on his show too.
Did he have the clock on when you met him?
No, not when we went to breakfast.
he doesn't wear it all at every Waffle House he visits.
Apparently not.
I had a couple of different questions for you, but I know we're bumping up against the time we said we called, and I want to be respectful, so I got to make sure that they're good questions. Got to ask about COVID-19, because this day and age, that's just silly not to bring that up. Like, what's the thing we're all thinking about? Yeah. So anytime we talk about it, I always mention we are recording this July 9th. Anything that happens beyond July 9th when this airs, we're not talking about it because we don't know what's happened yet. But how has quarantine impacted your writing life, and how do you foresee that impacting your book launch coming up, and how are you going to be working around that? Although I realize I'm asking you about September, that might as well be 10 years from now with the news moves.
You know, when I made the comment about how my ninth book is first person and how that was a challenge for me. So what I didn't indicate was that quarantine definitely impacted that. My day job switched to remote in March. And so we had to get used to, you know, working from home. And granted, what we do is easy to do from home, but still that whole kind of not having that separation from my day job to my home was huge because I was on deadline. And so normally I'd be able to write at lunch or, you know, kind of come home, have dinner with my family, and then, you know, sit down and write for another couple of hours about 8 o'clock. But by being home all the time, one would think, oh, well, that's cool. Like you're home all the time, but I had no separation. And I found that my day job just constantly just kept creeping longer each day, making it harder for me to write because I'd just be too tired. So quarantine made it tough to get that book finished. And it was due in May, and I ended up having to ask for an extension because if quarantine wasn't hard enough, when George Floyd was killed, it just really, you know, just the thinking about the humanity of Black people and how we are still trying to fight to be seen as human really messed me up for a couple of weeks, and I just couldn't focus on the book. So it did finally get finished, but I do think that, you know, when we talked earlier about me being able to usually write a tighter book, I think this is probably the first time that it's probably not as tight. And I remember saying to my agent, I said that to my agent, and she said, so it took a pandemic and racial tensions before you were, you know, not able to deliver a book. Who would have thought? So, you know, she's like trying to tell me to show myself some grace, you know, but she's right. But trying to write right now has been hard on all of us, you know, on any of us. But there are other things we want to focus on. So quarantine did impact that. But I don't really worry too much about how it's going to impact Turning Point because there's nothing I can do about it. And, you know, I'm going to continue to do what I've been doing, which is networking with educators, because they are the ones who get my books to people for the most part. So it's important to me that I stay in touch with them and that I, you know, understand what challenges they have when it comes to getting books in the hands of their readers. So I'm more focused on that. I mean, the book is going to do what it's going to do. So we'll see.
Well, you mentioned it. I've talked around the edges, but obviously, Black Lives Matter is a tremendous movement right now. And in some ways, it feels every time I record a new episode of the show, I think, is this the most effective use of my time right now, talking about books and authors when should be finding a way to support Black Lives Matter and that movement? What are you doing, or what have you been doing, to support Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, I've always tried to use my voice to advocate for inclusion, and whether that's inclusion, racial inclusion, or whether that's not forgetting, you know, our 13 to 15 year olds. So that's just you know, sort of my platform, that's my passion, is to make sure these things happen. The difference since the Black Lives Matter movement has like really been in the forefront the last couple of months has been to make sure that people understand that part of being against racism and being anti and getting rid of anti-Blackness is to make sure that you're exposing yourselves to things other than Black pain. I have used the term Black pain porn before when I'm referring to things like showing the video over and over again of this man being killed, or just, you know, constantly exposing not just Black kids, but all kids to books where the Black people are always constantly struggling, enough. And so for me, the only thing that's changed in my messaging is to remind people that one of the easiest ways to, you know, to do your part is to do things and expose yourself to remind yourself of Black people's humanity. So I haven't really changed what I do. I've just tried to make people understand that there are ways that they can impact the children that they nurture with a few very simple changes to what they put in front of those children.
So what are some easy changes that people listening could make?
Well, first is exactly what I said, you know, enough with the Black pain. We've got to look for and amplify images, stories, experiences of Black joy so that people see the whole Black person. When we're talking about trying to make kids in particular more empathetic, you can't do that if you're constantly only showing the Black pain aspect. There's just so much more to it. So, you know, being able to put the right material in front of a diverse amount of material, because the struggle is real. But I just mean making sure that there are, you know, three Black joy books for every two books that may be about struggle or social justice. Just mix it up a little bit. Being able to have very real conversations with one another about the unlearning that so many of us are going to have to do moving forward. So I know sometimes it seems like it's difficult, but it's not. And it just kind of starts with that recognition that we want to be recognized for our whole experience. You know, the history books tend to focus on slavery and then civil rights as if nothing happened in between and nothing has happened since. So it's about breaking that mindset, and especially when it involves talking to kids.
So if you've sat down and you've watched Fruitvale Station, good. You've had that experience. Now break out Flavor of Love. A couple of episodes of that. That's some Black excellence on display that will elevate that moment.
I'm not sure if I want to call that Black excellence, but okay.
You know what? Creed 1 and 2, get yourself the Black Panther. Just to make it a Ryan Coogler marathon, you'll be fine. My last question, Paul, is always some variation of, if there was a bit of advice or as much advice as you like that you could go back and give to yourself at the start of your career that would make your path easier and that might make easier the paths of those different authors and writers listening to us now, what would you go back and tell yourself?
You know what? I would tell myself that to show myself some grace. I almost feel like all writers believe that once they get that contract, then it's easy after that, or I don't know. And so you, everything you do after that, because you believe it's supposed to be easier, ends up being stressful because it's not easier. It's just the start. It's just a different leg of your writing career. You start to have some good problems, you know, being under contract and having a book to write at the same time that you're having a book to promote, or having a book to write at the same time that you're doing copy edits for another book. Like, those are great, wonderful problems, but they are still stressful. And being able to recognize that, you know, it's a marathon, and that it's okay that you're stressed out about all these wonderful things, it's really important. You stress out and you feel ungrateful, like, well, you know, there are other people who are still really trying. But the fact is that it is stressful. Publishing, the industry, is still incredibly competitive, and we're still, for the most part, you know, not necessarily paid what our creativity is worth in some respects. So, you know, show yourself some grace is what I would tell myself. Like, just like, enjoy every step. And when it gets hard, show yourself some grace.
I think that is the perfect note to end on. Paula Chase, where can esteemed audience find you online, stalk you, buy all your books, all that good stuff?
My website is paulachasebooks.com, And I'm on Twitter. My handle is at ThatMGBookChick. I'm also on Instagram, but I'm not on it as much, but I'm at that Paula Chase there.
As always, esteemed audience, find me at middlegradeninja.com. Download your free copy of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees. You know who I am. Come by and say hi once in a while. Paula Chase, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for making the time and for being just a truly excellent guest this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Esteemed audience, God willing that I'm alive. I'll see you next week.